Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 23rd, 2024. So Tom, what do you got for us?
All right, so kick it off. First thing I got here, article from Mandy entitled, "An Offer You Can Refuse. UNC 2970 Backdoor Deployment Using Trojanized PDF Reader." So Mandiant identified a group that is believed to be tied to North Korea. They are labeling them as UNC 2970. This group targets victims through false job openings, acting as like a recruiter from a well-known recruiting company. And they use this technique to target candidates for specific vectors or industries, like someone that may have worked in or does work in energy or finance, etc. And they would manipulate the job descriptions to provide an angle to target specific individual experiences, like a preferred education or skill item listed as something like maybe being in the Air Force or the military, as example. So when they engage with the users, typically over email or WhatsApp, they would share a malicious archive with a job description file that was a PDF. The PDF would be encrypted, and they would only be able to open that PDF with a tool called Sumatra PDF, which is a legitimate PDF tool. But no worries, the victim was ready to go, had everything they needed. UNC 2970 was kind enough to include a Trojanized version of the Sumatra PDF tool. And this is how they would deliver the MistPen backdoor via what's called Burnbook Launcher. So a couple quick synopsises on this one. Burnbook is a launcher capable of executing encrypted payloads stored in a file like a job description PDF or on disk. It's disguised as a legitimate DLL for the Sumatra PDF application, which will allow the PDF of topic to be read by the user, showing legitimacy, but in the background begins loading into memory the payload named MistPen. Burnbook also contained a network check, which I found interesting, to verify that the device was connected to the internet. It would not allow the PDF to be open unless it could verify that it could connect to the internet. MistPen is a Trojanized version of Notepad++, which contains a backdoor primarily used to download and execute portable executable files, or PE files, and it communicates over HTTP leveraging Microsoft Graph URIs and includes a sleep-wake timer for signaling and working with the C2. So the campaign reported on targeting folks that were interested or from multinational energy companies specifically this time around. But the campaign lore methodology seems to be evolving, and mixed with the job climate that we live in, I can kind of only imagine how effective this strategy would be. But ultimately, Scott, I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on that or any other takeaways you had from the article.
Yeah, so one of the takeaways that I thought was kind of an interesting thought that I kind of came to, because you see it a lot, and I remember back in my early days when you would see reports, technical reports, and they would use Google as a way to check connectivity, and all the security folks would be like, well, that's not a good way where we could detect it, right? We'd be like, yeah, if I'm looking for when things talk to Google, I'm going to find so much noise in that, that'd be unreliable, right? But then I was actually thinking more about some of the telemetry that's very easily available, and that is when you look at, Google.com, obviously it's got to have IP addresses associated with it, right? So, based on those IP addresses where that domain exists with Sysmon data, very easily, if you were to just map out what are the IP addresses for Google.com and say, if there's any processes that are reaching out to Google.com, especially like weird processes, just having that telemetry might actually enable you to actually look for Google.com connectivity. And I want to say even in the Sysmon data, it will include a domain that's registered. If that's associated, I can't remember now off the top of my head, but I think I remember seeing that too. So effectively, like if you see a random EXE reaching out to Google.com, especially if it's not even a Google-owned product or application, I think it would be highly suspect. And a lot of, I mean, if you're talking back 10 years or so or more, you know, malware authors have been using google.com to verify internet connectivity. So I thought that might be an interesting way to actually look for suspicious things that may be happening, especially when you have a sophisticated attack kind of like this. The other thing is their use of search order hijacking. So, you know, they're copying the BDE UI SRV, which I believe is associated with BitLocker, if I remember correctly. But either way, you know, they're pulling a legitimate executable out of the System32 location and copying it over and then placing the appropriate DLLs locally next to it, even though it's the malicious version, the one they want to actually be executed adjacent to it. So when the executor, when they actually have a scheduled task that executes that, then you are able to load in the malicious DLL. Because if you don't recall how search order hijacking works with DLL injection, is typically it'll look for first, I think it's a hard coded location that's in the code that says load this DLL at this specific location. Then it looks where if the DLL exists next to it, like in the same directory. And then if the DLL isn't there, then it falls back to the System32 location where DLLs exist that it might use from the system. And so it kind of takes advantage of that by moving it, the DLL close to it, even though it's legitimate executable. So that's something that was interesting when you see executables and DLLs being dropped in the same location and it's not a system directory. You know, usually you can start to suspect possible DLL hijacking from that type of behavior. So that was also very interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's always really cool to see like advanced type of attacks where there's a lot going on. And then try to pull apart like those small pieces that might give you kind of an edge. Because not only that, like I said, when I mentioned the Google thing, I mean, that's not just talking about this specific malware, right? Or these specific malicious tool sets. That's used by many others. So when you start pulling out those pieces that are commonly shared, it also gives you a better chance to leverage that detection or approach on other things. And then also System32, like being aware of what executables are in System32 directories or SysWOW64, like system-specific executables, when you see those executing outside of those common directories, like, you know, people talk about lol bins all the time, lay of the land binaries, it's one of those things where if you're able to even do a brief inventory of those and say, hey, do we see these being used outside of these locations where they must reside for normal system operation? Yeah, those are huge red flags as well. So there's some basic things I think you can do to actually kind of get a grip on identifying these types of complicated attacks.
Yeah, I agreed a lot on that. That was a lot of the thinking that I had from this, is more of that kind of unstructured hunt approach, right? Like looking for what is calling out to google.com. You referenced that perfectly, and you could get and see a lot of things that might be noisy or even normal to your environment. But when you take a, you know, an approach like this, you could learn so much about what's actually happening in your environment and be able to build exclusion lists, do all kinds of different things with your hunt to where it's valuable or successful, identify stuff that you might not actually see. These are good triggers for me, or to me and my brain, to go look for stuff like that. So yeah, good points. What do you got next for us, man?
Yeah, so the next one was, it was a blog on cloudsec.com, and it was called Unmasking the Danger, Luma Stealer Malware Exploits Fake Capture Pages. So what's interesting here is I've seen this come up time and time again. This might be a repeat of something before, or maybe other people are using the same technique. I can't recall. But I know this was a little while back where something very similar was doing this. But essentially, you would fall onto a malicious website. And then the CAPTCHA, as far as clicking on the CAPTCHA, it would have like verification instructions where basically it would ask you to do Windows key R, which would basically kick up the run window of Windows, do a control V, which would paste whatever was copied to your clipboard into that run key line, and then you press enter. And basically what was happening is there was a PowerShell script that was Base64 encoded that when run would actually download the malicious file and infect the system, which was the Luma Stealer. And it was just interesting because, you know, it's always common that attackers are going to use our typical processes for verifications and protections or whatever it is. Like, for instance, you just think about password stealing landing pages, right? Like, we're used to getting hit with some sort of page where we have to put in our password and username, and then we move on to having access to what it is we're putting our passwords into. So what do attackers do? They copy what those pages look like, make the fake page. So when you put in your password on the wrong page, they're stealing the password as to what you think may be used. And they have different ways to say, you know, redirect and make it look like it failed. So you just put it in again and, you know, you're none the wiser. But something to think about for this, right? Kind of a basic technique. They do kick off a hidden Windows PowerShell window. They do use encoded commands. But, you know, when I look at something like this, I start to think, well, what does that look like from the data perspective? And obviously, if you're going to run something from the Windows run command, it's going to be launched by Explorer. And so some people might think, okay, yeah, Explorer launching anything is basically like the user double-clicking something you're typing in PowerShell and opening PowerShell, right? But the difference is if you're running something from Explorer potentially and it has these types of behaviors with the PowerShell, right? You have Explorer as a parent, but now you have PowerShell running a hidden command or an encoded command, or maybe other types of malicious PowerShell behavior that you're familiar with. You know, that could be a sign of specifically maybe this technique. There might be other techniques that might overlap with too, right? Someone tricks you into basically executing PowerShell, or PowerShell is pulled down in some way and executed that has Explorer as the parent. Sure. But if you're really concerned about this, I feel like you could be chasing your tail by looking for what web pages are malicious and trying to block those ahead of time, or having good threat intel to track them down before your victim. But if you're just looking for Explorer and you take some of the key elements out of their PowerShell, and it's even more powerful if you've got the proper PowerShell logging turned on, so you have PowerShell transcripts, because then that entire encoded command now gets decoded and logged, right? Which is now you can actually say, this is exactly what's happening, and these are exactly the patterns and behaviors I'm looking for, which kind of tears this whole approach down if you're looking at the right data. The right way. So that was the first thing that stood out to me, was actually focusing just on that delivery technique, not on the stealer itself. But obviously I've been seeing this more, so I expect to see more of this in general, because it seems to work pretty well. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, and this technique I think is really just interesting, you know, having people kind of copy paste code and open up a run window or actually launch, but I think we've seen in the past where they actually instructed people to launch a PowerShell with admin rights and then go ahead and copy and paste this thing in there. This one was a little more slick. It, you know, it was an auto copy with the click on the verify button, and then it just gave you a couple quick steps. So you really had three clicks and a couple keys, and you were off and running. I don't know. I feel like we're seeing that more and more. I'm generally curious about what the success rate is, because I can kind of see how dangerous that can be. I think everyone could. The other part thinking about too is, like, as this technique kind of rises, what are companies going to have to do to educate their people a little more on this, you know? Yeah. Most of the people that are falling for it generally don't understand what they're actually doing, I would think.
Which I think it also speaks to, like, you know, being an IT or being an administrator, if someone said, go to run as and do control V, first you typically know what run as is and you know what control V does. Immediately, I feel like those people will be like, well, this is weird, right? Mm-hmm. Anyone else that doesn't use those types of techniques or those types of functions within the system, those are the subjects or the targets, right? So,
right. Yeah. The low hanging fruit, right? People that aren't, they totally won't know what's going on. Yeah. And then you were talking on some of the ways to, like, look, this had me kind of chasing down that rabbit hole. How can I see activity that happened when somebody executes something out of or launches something from a run window, right? You stole the thunder on the Explorer thing, but something else to chase down. I am curious, maybe, you know, because I'm not off the top of my head, I'm not sure. And I kind of want to play with it in the lab a little bit. Sysmon event ones, I wonder if there's any kind of stitch tag or indicator that it was coming from a run window or not, but maybe it's still just representing Explorer. But in a lot of those process events, you can even see some of the command line or the line entries that are there that would launch the thing, right? So it made me think about wanting to go chase that down, but there's some ignorance I have right now that I have to, you know, kind of learn up.
Yeah, the one bummer I did see in the article, though, was there was still a single letter file, but it was just a file they were hosting on their side, right? They didn't move it over to the system they're targeting, so they were pulling the content from an a.txt. But it just goes to the show, attackers will still use that kind of stuff, right? It's just simple and easy. But I like seeing it, even though in this case you wouldn't be able to use it as a way to identify the behavior.
No, but the PowerShell logging one, though, that's absolute, right? So, I mean, I'd be suspect or at least want to be educated on what's running in my environment that's running hidden windows in the background. You know, non-standard stuff would be pretty easy to pick out that with that behavior.
I might take my comment back. If you were looking at web traffic and looking at, you know, files with single letter names, you can easily pick common file extensions at the end of the URL and look for where it basically is breaking with a single letter and say, well, why are we downloading 1.exe or why are we downloading, you know? And so, yeah, you actually may be able to see some context there, right, that may be worthwhile. And I believe if you look at the user agent specifically, you might be able to tell it was PowerShell driven versus just a normal browser, right? So that would even be more questionable. So, you know, there might actually be more opportunities here that since I haven't like dug into that, recreating this, to actually identify similar types of behaviors, even if it's just, you know, bits and pieces of the behavior. So, cool.
All right. I'm next.
Yep.
Okay. So the second article I had today for us was from Unit 42, titled "Gleaming Pisces Poison Python Packages." That's I just now realized what kind of tongue twister that is. "Gleaming Pisces Poison Python Packages Campaign Delivers PondRat Linux and macOS Backdoors." So researchers identified activity around ongoing Poison Python packages delivering these backdoors. And the attackers behind the campaign uploaded several Poison Python packages to PyPy, which is a popular open source repo. And they dubbed this the artifacts they found as PondRat. And it's basically, well, it is a lighter version of a similar known macOS remote admin tool or rat called PoolRat. So the Poison Python packages that have since been removed from the PyPy repo were identified as a real-ids, colored txt, beautiful text, and mini sound. For any of you that want to go chase and see if those are actually active somewhere in your environment, PondRat main function showed the use of the fconnect proxy, which handles connections to their C2, sets up a URI as well as parameters of the HTTP requests. It also leveraged the accept request handle to parse and decrypt commands from C2. And being a pathway for executing commands for remote operators. PondRat, being a lightweight version of PoolRat, enables the use of these commands just for a shorter list of things. So it's specifically focused to be allowed to upload or download files, check an implant status to confirm if it's active, instructing the implant to pause operations for a given duration of time, like a sleep command or something like that. And then executing commands with an option to either retrieve their output or not. So, you know, kind of a short one, pretty straightforward article. But what I found most interesting, Scott, is just really thinking a little more on the poisoning of Python packages and repos like this to kind of gain that foothold. I mean, they even mentioned in the article that entry technique and you know, kind of what the researchers believed was to target, you know, very early stages of getting into supply chain processes. So yeah, I was curious what you think there, or if there was anything else that stood out to you, Scott.
Yeah, so it's Poison Python packages. It would be a very tough thing to get in front of, right? I mean, not very many people are going to be doing code review on everything, and you know, how to keep track of that. Like, I'll be honest, I've never taken the time to figure out what's the most appropriate way to dig into that. I just know it's a hard problem to solve because I've seen, you know, the conversations that usually wrap around some of those things. But what was really interesting is in this case, I think there's very easily detectable behavior for the types of behaviors from the packages that were poisoned by this actor specifically. So I don't know if every actor is going to do the same thing, but it really was figure one that stood out to me the most. And so figure one shows pretty much the process execution of what that Python is actually running. And essentially in this case, it will do, and what's interesting about the figure as well, if I know people can't see it, but Python runs three separate kind of command paths, right? But they kind of have it in the wrong order. So from bottom is like the first action, and then you work your way to the second one or the third one. The last action is actually at the top, but I think they put it at the top because the OS helper file, the malicious payload there that had Pondrat, was the one they detected. So obviously they want to highlight, you know, and that's what, like a visual aid to say, hey, look, we found this. But this is what's really cool about threat hunting, right? Looking at this behavior, everything about this whole behavior looks bad, but they're able to find Pondrat based on the payload itself, right? And so when you look at that, the behavior, Python is running a shell, it's running bash, right? To run curl, which is then downloading OS helper, right? Through some of the arguments and stuff they use. That's cool. But one of the things, if you ever use Linux systems and you download any kind of files you want to execute, the next thing you have to do is you have to chmod it. So then Python is running another shell instance to then run chmod with the plus X argument, which basically says make this executable. So then they can then execute it. And then Python's running a shell, which then runs another shell, which then runs the OS helper file that's Pondrat. And so there's some interesting things here. One, I forgot to mention the other significant thing about chmod is there are a few ways to get around having to chmod a file locally to make it executable. And one of the other ways is if you actually compile it locally. So sometimes when you see attackers compile their code on the target, one, it increases the reliability that it'll run, but two, you don't have to actually change it executable. Then the compilation of it, you can make it executable on compile. So you can skip that whole step. But it adds more complexity, right? But it's just an interesting technique people use. But Python has the ability to actually run these things without kicking off bash. Like it can run curl, it's a binary, it can run chmod, and it can definitely run the payload OS helper. So there is not necessarily a reason to run the bash or the shell, which I think is interesting. Now, but if you're looking at maybe some analytics that is trying to get around, every single one of those shell instances is only going to run one of those commands. So if you're, say, you're trying to identify, yeah, there's a shell session and it runs all these malicious commands within that session, right? It would break that apart so much that you wouldn't be able to stitch those together to say, oh, this all came from the same behavior. But when you have Python running multiple shell commands within a tight window, suspicious, right? And then if you're looking at when someone's making something executable, suspicious. When you have, if you can even combine that, what's making something executable is also being curled, something else suspicious. But the really interesting thing is the double shell before actually running the malicious file. So there's a lot of pieces of where this could be broken down. And you know, I really focus on this graphic because there's so much there you can do as far as building your identification by focusing on individual pieces, see how they look in your environment as far as, is this something that happens a lot? Is this something I can actually build something on? Do I need to aggregate some of these behaviors together? You know, they're, like you can really break this apart in many different ways and learn a lot by doing it. But when I look at reports like this, and we even had a really technical report earlier, I immediately kind of break things up into two things, right? Like, what are we going to do about it? How do we explain or why do we care? And I feel like all that incredible detail of like what things do falls into how do we explain or why do we care when you need to have that conversation with other peers, management, or whatever. But I immediately, when I saw this graphic, I looked for any other types of details like this, and the graphic really had everything in it. And so I would really just start there and figuring out how to solve it from that information. If I were to try to look for this in my environment or similar techniques, right? Now the problem is this technique specifically doesn't solve the, you know, malicious Python packages problem, right? This is how this actor implements this. So you're focusing kind of more on actor specific behavior, but by looking at this, if people, then you might break outside the box. Well, gosh, the Python's going to run other things. Maybe you have to take a step back where maybe someone actually writes Python not to use shell. It just runs those commands directly. Like, you know, you start to get a little creative when you think about that. That's just how I looked at this. No, that's what stood out. I think it's actually useful things for people to focus on to build off of.
Yeah, for sure. Just a short expansion on that. I mean, it's generally how I tend to approach a lot of articles. Usually the first thing I do is like, there's this natural, you know, you think you're indexing something for a research or something like that. The natural first thing I see is, oh, what do I know I could have visibility on? What do I have high confidence that I could have visibility on? And I start picking out those artifacts to see, okay, what can I chase down? And then you stitch them together as you gather more of the information from the article, what it's trying to do, and you can find your way to create those complex thoughts of how to track that behavior and things like that. And just small insights into a couple crazy minds, but I wanted to add to it.
Yeah, and I forgot to highlight more what I mentioned early on, is everything I described on identifying was well before the said tool identified it, right? Which I think is hugely powerful, because at the end of the day, if in this case it was a Palo tool, if it didn't identify the pond rat payload, then there would be no clue any of this happened, because all the behaviors to pull it down and from those malicious Python packages was not identified, right? And this is why I always say threat hunting has a great fit in there. And commonly, threat hunting does sometimes find things before the detection are bad, right? So you can actually see ahead of it. The only problem is threat hunting isn't a real-time process. So even though your visibility might be earlier in the stack, it's whenever you decide to threat hunt for it and how you schedule it and what you do, and hopefully make those into real-time detections, if depending, environment dependent. But it's always cool to see that. Like, I'm actually looking at behaviors that the detections aren't being built on. But granted, the way I have to manually do those things, or the way I have to implement those, is different. So it makes sense.
Yeah. We'll never forget, threat hunting isn't isolated, right? You should always consider trying to find things that you can put in that operational phase, right, from your threat hunting, right? I mean, it's simple thought, but we should echo it as continuously as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you got next for us, Scott?
So next one was just a really interesting concept, right? And it was a dark reading article, and it was for just $20, researchers seize part of the internet infrastructure. And it's really talking about, if people are familiar with Whois, right? Whois is a way where you can look at who owns what domains, what information is about those domains. I mean, Whois is actually a command you can run too, right? So that you can sit there and say, oh, I want to find where is this, the owner of this domain is at this address, this has, the admin of the domain is, you know, this email address and those types of things. So it provides a lot of information around ownership of domains. And, you know, nowadays too, there's a lot of people that let you register domains that privatize that. So then it's all private information, so it doesn't actually list it out. But why this is important is, there were some researchers from Watchtower. They were looking at one of the Whois domains, and it was the Whois dot, and then spelled out dot mobiregistry.net. And they basically migrated that to a different domain, which is whois.nic.mobi. And Mobi is, if from people that aren't familiar with .mobi, it's the top level domain for mobile optimized sites. Does that have to be used for that? Absolutely not. But it was just kind of, it's what the common usage for when you see a .mobi, it's supposed to be for, you know, consistently mobile optimized sites. But they migrated to that new domain, and in last December, the old one expired, right? So this research group for $20, you know, which is the average cost for most domains, picked it up. They bought it just for curiosity's sake, I'm guessing. Maybe they saw it was there and like, oh, I'm wondering, you know, does anyone still use this kind of thing? So when they spun it up, to their surprise, over, you know, in just a couple hours, they had 76,000 unique IP addresses sending queries to that server where they stood up that domain. And in about 2 days, that went over to about 2.5 million queries from 135,000 unique systems worldwide. And so what could be the cause of this? Well, it could be older services where this is like a hard-coded domain to validate these types of things. Maybe there's specific botnets out there that are using, you know, this specific thing. You know, who knows? But it just means that there is hard-coded or archaic kind of things trying to reach out to the service that it clearly has migrated to something new. And it's static, because even when the domain went offline potentially for a little bit, you know, no one noticed anything breaking. But then the question kind of came, well, gosh, how could this be used maliciously, right? Other than just seeing when people are querying, doing Whois traffic potentially to kind of get an idea of what domains are gathering information about and from where, you kind of get a feel of behavior there. But one of the big weaknesses is there are some CA, certificate authorities. So if people don't know what a certificate authority is, they're the groups that are supposed to be already validated, already trusted, that sign the certificates that make websites HTTPS, right? If it's HTTPS, that means there's a certificate that's been assigned by a CA to whoever owns that website to validate that they are the owner of that website. And so therefore that website can have a little bit higher levels of trust. And then they can actually do encrypted traffic as well. But in this case, they are able to change the records in the Whois data. So when something would ask questions about a domain, it would send the email address that they put in the data, right, back to whoever's making the request. So there's some CA authorities, and they had one specifically mentioned here, where if you wanted to get a cert, all they would do is do a Whois lookup. It went to this server. They're able to say, oh, send us the email, which was basically an email for verification that you click the link, and then boom, you got your, so they were able to basically, create, authorized certificates for websites they didn't own, which then enables them to potentially set up similar domains, right? That would appear valid, and also phishing domains, make it easier to phish. Basically sets up some reliable looking trusting infrastructure the search is supposed to protect you from people stealing your domains, duplicating things and things like that. Now they would have the capability to do this based on just this simple $20 purchase. But what I loved about this and things like this is it really does highlight the process of for how things work, and highlights not only is it got like, so you get an understanding of like, oh, that's how that works, but also the weaknesses that are associated with it, right? Like, it's amazing that, you know, when a domain's being validated, it really just goes to whatever email address you put on your registration data to be able to get that verified, right? It seems too easy. You want things convenient, but obviously in this instance, like, you have like a source of information that may not be as reliable based on how it's being maintained or whatnot. But it's always fascinating when researchers uncover these things. Now, granted, is this something we should overly be worried about? It's really hard to say. I don't see it happening all over the place. This was just a really interesting study, but this falling into the wrong hands, like, the possibilities, I don't want to say are endless, but you get a really creative group out there with this kind of capability. I'm pretty sure they can create some pretty sophisticated attacks by thinking through a lot of different avenues. So it was really just a cool read just to understand the implications of this. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. It was an interesting one. And first thing I thought, it was like, wow, one, how could this happen? Like, is it that big of a gap? You know, just thinking about, you have this major domain registry site that's registered, right? And like, you just let it expire, and it's been like a mainstay for X amount of time, right? It was the main one for the MOBI, the dot MOBI, and you just let it expire and just created a new one and moved on. It's like, of course there's going to be a lot of people out there that are still pointing to that one, right?
Yeah.
So why not just maintain it as a mechanism for just assurance, like, just always maintain it so you never have to worry about that problem, right?
Or redirect the other, own it and redirect it.
Own it and redirect. Right, exactly. Like, it seemed like it would have easily, it seemed like a really small but big miss. It's happy that researchers found this and not necessarily the bad guys, because I don't think me and you can necessarily, just here in a couple of minutes and after reading this article, really quantify what could be done with this. But The door seems to be open wide enough that it's scary to think of the possibilities, right? I mean, just a couple of things that kind of emphasize this in the article, where they talked about the query, the Watchtower's domain, once they took it, what kind of hits they were getting from it, from who, and that, you know, there was a lot of government organizations from many different countries. Security organizations like VirusTotal were, you know, going to this, they're still directing to the old MOBI server, right? So, or domain. But yeah, this is it's interesting to think about. I feel like this is an easy thing to solve. Not necessarily, I wouldn't think this would be some kind of systemic thing, but it was one of those, like, you dodged the vehicle screaming at you down the street kind of thing.
Yeah, and what's also, I think, interesting, just thinking from a timing perspective, and, you know, this is completely making assumptions, what I'm about to say, but, you know, they said this expired last December, and, you know, we're talking about this in September. I don't know when the data was specifically pulled, or what data is currently now based on this information. But if you still have things talking to something that doesn't exist 9 months down the road, then based on those sources, if you were able to look into where those things are coming from, you'd have to think, are there unmanaged servers or services, right? And if you know there's unmanaged services or servers, then you have to think, well, what kind of other vulnerabilities may exist if I now put eyes on that, knowing that things aren't being updated or managed potentially, right? If it's a software suite of things and everything else is managed except for that one software suite didn't rip the thing out, not a big deal. But if what I'm saying is a possibility, now you've at least created a subset of things to put your eye on. And if it is a software that isn't being maintained, that a lot of other places are using, you find one other hole. Now you have a whole list of possible victims based on a hole you discovered through just identifying poorly managed infrastructure. So you know, like, whether that possibility is real, I don't know. But I usually tend to think that when things fall through the cracks, that means there's less management involved as far as maintaining those things. So I assume there's other weaknesses or potential problems. So, it's just always interesting to kind of like, you can run through like the rabbit hole of scenarios, right? But it's just a cool little idea and find for sure.
Yeah. Good article.
Well, cool. I got two things I really want to bring up. One is right around the corner, October 2nd, from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have our threat hunting workshop. It's hunting for collection. So it's focusing on that vertical in the MITRE. It's going to be delivered by Lee Arcanol, who's done all the ones in the past, and Jorge Rodriguez, who I think did the one previous to this, and it was a popular hit. So definitely check that out. And if not, you can't check it out live, definitely register so it's easier to find to check it out later. Those are all interactive, so you're able to actually get your hands on data and kind of walk along with us. The next is we have our live version of this podcast. We kind of took a break over the summer, so we're kind of coming back to it. It should be exciting. It's going to take place October 24th. It is a 7 to 8:30 p.m. It's in the evening. Very relaxed, very chill. Try to get on there. We involve Discord, so we try to have some live interaction with people that want to partake. And it's called Blood, Sweat, and Threats, Carving the Perfect Threat Hunter. So we really will be touching on, you know, the three phases or so of when you want to start out in threat hunting to what looks like the perfect outcomes of threat hunting, and how we kind of get there, how we think about it as you know, as the host of the podcast. And also would love to hear any insights from people participating as well that want to add to the conversation. That would be great. So definitely check that out. We'll be doing, you know, other reminders you'll see posted in social media and through future podcasts itself. But, you know, that's it for this one. So I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And so that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 23rd, 2024. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.